Naturally Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts, where we continue our look behind the doors at the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine. I'm James Bergen. Joining me today we have Dr. Barbara Helm, a lecturer at the Institute. Hi Barbara, welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Hi James.
Now, Barbara completed her PhD in 2003, and it was titled Seasonal Timing in Different Environments, Comparative Studies in Stonechats. This was conducted at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. From there, she went on to a faculty associate position at the University of Konstanz, also in Germany, before joining us in 2012. You seem to hold a number of additional posts, so stop me if I get any of these wrong. You are the President of the European Ornithologists Association. You are Deputy Director of SEEN, the Scottish Centre of Ecology and Natural Environment, located on the banks of Loch Lomond. You are a faculty board member of the prestigious International Max Planck Research School of Organismal Biology. And you are a working group co-chair for the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, or COST, working group Loss of the Night, which looks at the effects of artificial nighttime illumination. Is that right?
Yes.
How you have time to talk to us or get anything done, I have no idea, because that seems like an incredible amount of roles. Is there anything else on top of that we should be aware of? Or
no, that's that... fine.
So you sum up your field largely in terms of chronobiology.
Yes, I'm equally interested really in chronobiology and ornithology. So
okay.
It's a balance.
So how would you describe chronobiology to those of us who might not be aware of exactly what the term means?
Yeah, it's basically just the study of timing in biology, chronobiology, but it's particularly interested in the kind of rhythms and the timing with respect to the predictable environmental cycles, like tidal cycles, annual cycles, daily cycles, and so on.
Okay, so just overall field of biological clocks.
Yes, yes, and it's quite integrative, so you can look at it from, say, a behavioral side, ecological side, you can look at gene expression, you can look at the physiology that drives these rhythms and so on. It's one of the things I like, that it brings together lots of different sort of subfields of biology.
So it's very integrative and collaborative.
Yes.
Excellent. So maybe you could explain to us a bit about what your specific research focuses are on just now.
Okay, so I've been just... it's kind of a funny marriage between ornithology and biological rhythms. And one of the things that had struck people so often was that birds are so particularly, you know, visibly well-timed in many ways. People have always wondered how migratory birds, for example, came back at exactly the right time for spring here when they were overwintering, for example, in Africa. So these are the kind of things that have also just... That's what keeps me awake at night. And so we're looking into that. I'm interested in annual cycles, specifically migration, but I'm also equally interested in the daily cycles, like how, for example, birds prepare, and humans for that matter, prepare to be up and ready in the morning just before the sun goes up, and so on.
And so this kind of ties in with your loss of night involvement, so looking at the effect of artificial illumination on bird populations?
Yes, that's right. And not just on sort of, well, on different aspects of the birds, actually, really. Just, again, from behavior to gene expression and possibly immunosuppression and other effects.
Nice. So maybe we could kind of focus in on some of the particular projects that you're involved with. So a lot of people may be seeing bird boxes around Kelvin Grove Park, just outside the university. I believe you're involved in their sudden appearance.
Yes, yes. But also this is mainly driven by Davide Dominoni, who also works here in this institute, and we're doing this together. So it's a big sort of comparison along several locations between the university, or the city of Glasgow, and also the field station SEEN at the other end, and a few places in between. And this summer, David has been mostly checking the city boxes, and I've been mostly checking the forest boxes. But it's been super interesting to compare these, the way the birds were breeding this year.
Nice. And of course, it provides ample student projects as well. I believe that you and David have had some master's helpers this year.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's a comparison. I think it'll be a project of many years to kind of understand what's going on. But what we do see is that the biological signal is very strong. There's large differences between the forest and the city, but to sort out precisely what's happening is a big task and will involve many good and engaged students.
Nice. But it's not just around the Glasgow area. You have other projects with a PhD student, Ian Malzer, in other parts of Scotland, and I believe there's some work with African birds as well.
Yes, so Ian Malzer is a Carnegie PhD student, so he brought his own project, and it's super interesting. He's intrigued by a very charismatic species, often called tit, but it's not really a tit. It's a bearded reedling. And it breeds, it's a specialist that breeds in reed beds, and actually the Tay reed beds, just along the River Tay, hold like an unexpectedly large population of these birds, and it's definitely the northernmost in the UK. And it's pretty much the edge of the distribution range, and Ian is interested in these birds generally, in their movements, and in particular also in the reed bed management strategies that are best suited to help this bird.
And the African birds, is this the stonechats?
And we're quite active in Africa with stonechats. So it's another ex-PhD student, Kim Ortega, and I believe she'll be giving her own podcast.
Yep, we have that lined up.
So you'll hear more about it, and we have another postdoc here, Bea Apfelbeck, who also works with the stonechats, and I hope I can do more with those birds as well. This is a species that we've been studying in many places, including actually Ireland, so the British Isles at any rate. And it's maybe not a species anymore, but at least some sort of a group of closely related birds that are so widely spread that it gives us an opportunity to compare their seasonal strategies. And we study them right at the equator, where you would say that at least in terms of day length, the environment is constant across the year, and all the way up to Siberian stonechats up in Kazakhstan and other places where it's highly seasonal. But the project in Africa has developed its own more evolutionary spin, because there is actually quite a bit of seasonality that we sometimes tend to overlook coming from the Northern Hemisphere.
Think it's always sunny and always nice and always warm.
But from a bird's perspective, they're really like suitable and unsuitable seasons for breeding, and some birds actually quite tough to hold out. And so even on over short distances in Africa, there's large differences in the seasonality of these birds, and also large genetic differences. And Kim Motega has been looking at these genetic differences, and with respect to environmental separation, for example, between mountain ranges, but also effects of different times of year of breeding, whether this is maybe a driver of genetic isolation between populations.
Great, excellent. And you recently gave a talk to the Institute in which, if I remember correctly, you had quite an impressive slide with an international set of collaborations on what appeared to be a captive bird population.
Yes, that's two different parts to that. So mostly the stonechats, actually, again. So because we've been interested in sorting out what's like a direct response to the environment and what is based on timing programs. So that's the chronobiology part. Sort of like that it's not just only like a direct response to the environment, but that these birds are able to actually anticipate what's coming and sort of change and prepare in advance. And that's most easily shown on captive studies, sort of complementary to field studies. And so we've been doing this, and with this project right now we're at a stage where we're actually now looking at genomic differentiation of different stonechat groups. And that's being done with in collaboration with the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology over in Germany. Also, captive studies that we do include work with the Netherlands Institute for Ecology. And there, this institute is mostly interested in the timing of breeding relative to changing climate in Europe. And we've been doing a number of experiments with them where, again, we were able to sort of manipulate different environmental factors that mattered for the birds with respect to both annual and also daily timing. And among other things, we found that that's actually the way that the birds have internal rhythms is very specific to individuals. So there are individuals with faster clocks and slower clocks. And we're starting to think, and there's some evidence from other groups as well, that there may actually be sexual selection on the speed, actually the chronotype, if you so wish, the specific phenotype with respect to timing of these birds. But just collecting these bird samples and so on alone wouldn't help us here if we wouldn't have like fantastic collaborators that actually very generously offer their lab space and their expertise and really help us to sort of unlock some of these secrets. And many of these collaborators are actually not at the Graham Care Building, but at a second site of our institute on the GasCube campus. And there are a number of specialists, especially on animal health and physiology. And I feel very fortunate about opportunities at this institute for just learning very new things in my life.
Well, I think that is one of the real strengths of the institute, is that we have very good research teams both at the Graham Care Building and at GasCube, and we can take advantage of everyone's expertise and really get some good integrative collaborative work going. Well, that is an incredible amount of research. You obviously have a lot of collaborators, and people familiar with the Graham Care Building will know that you have a very large group in a very big office near the entrance, which is kind of a hive of activity. But you obviously have quite a lot of additional roles at the Institute, which are kind of on top of your research work. So maybe you could tell us a bit about what additional roles you as a PI have to take on.
Well, there are basically two roles that I have. And one is, as you mentioned earlier, I'm Deputy Director of the Field Station Scene. And there, I think my main role is trying to connect this wonderful field station that's only not even an hour away, but still remote and not always on people's minds. So connect that to the people at GasCube and at the Graham Care Building and just remind people of opportunities there. So it's almost like ambassadorial in some ways.
And indeed. I myself forgot to mention them a moment ago. We actually have three very good research centres.
We have
seen the Graham Care Building in GasCube.
Yes, but you did say it in the beginning, really. Yes, so there's a lot of potential there, but it's work. And then, of course, there are also parts of the job that, you know, that also need to be done. Just taking care of things there and coordinating and making plans and so on. And my second sort of job here at the Institute is involvement in the EU programs. And that's probably something that, you know, it's a good thing to have people from other European countries who have come in who maybe have a bit like additional or complementary insights into like how EU funding functions. And so I think especially for fundamental research, which is really where my heart is, the European Union offers quite a bit of funding, and I hope to make much of this, as much as possible, accessible for the great work at this institute.
Okay, so that's brilliant. That's a really clear idea of what you do in your research and your additional roles at the university. It sounds like an incredible amount of work. I'm not really sure when you sleep. So I guess I ask the question as to what made you want to become a scientist in the first place? What drew you into the field that you currently find yourself in?
Well, it's one of these things, maybe that you even sacrifice your sleep because you're just so happy doing it. Mm. And I feel very fortunate that I have a job that is also my hobby. Mm. You know, of course, sometimes you just have to make sure that you do catch enough sleep. But basically, it's what I always wanted to do. So I was one of these kids that were really interested in nature, in particular in birds. And then I was kind of adopted by bird ringers, specifically owl ringers, who took me up to climb up the Bavarian church steeples and get the owlets down for ringing. And you can imagine that maybe like a 9 or 10 year old would be sort of stuck for life. And from there I went, which was one of the nice things in ornithology, actually. I went as a volunteer to work in different projects, and that first brought me to the Max Planck Institute. And there I learned about bird migration, and I think I caught on with the idea of biological rhythms there.
Mm. It's easy to see what kind of drew you into your field and really captivated you about it. And I guess what's the best part of your job? You said you got to travel a lot. Is it getting to work with the birds? Is it the collaborators you get to work with?
That's a difficult question, really. I think there are probably three things that I really specifically enjoy about the job. One is the birds. The second one is the people. It's really something special in our job. I think that we can sort of mostly select the people we want to work with, and there's always like people who share your interest and your enthusiasm. And the third part is the relative freedom of the job. I mean, of course, there are things that need to be done, but there's still a big portion of the day when I can really think about what I want to do and do just that within my field of work.
And I guess you said that you are very much a fundamental scientist at heart, so that's fundamental as opposed to applied research, I assume. Is that, that's what you mean, yes?
Yeah, well, I'm always happy if there's a good application.
Oh, totally.
But it's not my, it's for me, it's the result and not the starting point of my research interest.
I can totally relate to that.
I can give you an example, for example. Okay. Because, as I said, I've done most of my work in the past with a view of bird migration. And I was quite involved in this field, and so was the Max Planck Institute at which I worked at the time. And then there was an outbreak of the bird flu and a real scare. And at that time, we had to set aside two full staff members, academics, just to answer public questions from health agencies, concerned citizens, media, and so on. And the questions were all of the sort like, well, there was a case of avian flu in this or that corner of Europe in, say, a swan or a pintail. Where will it likely show up next? Can you give us some idea, some warning? How in the world would you answer these questions if you hadn't, for example, just for the basic interest, observed bird migration for decades or centuries?
No, I completely agree. It's very much where my heart is as well, and I very much see the appeal and usefulness in fundamental research. But it is always interesting to figure out what scientists, what researchers might think is their most significant contribution to date, what the most important thing they've worked on so far has been.
So for my own perspective, I'm just interested in seeing how birds in terms of environmental change actually cope with the new conditions and how it's reconciled with these genetic programs. And that's, I think, where people probably position me. But I think the most general public interest was actually when we compared birds in the city and birds in the forest. And we looked at the effects of light on their biological clocks. And we found that actually city birds are much more fast-paced than forest birds, and have faster clocks, but also more disturbed clocks. And then I think we got like a huge amount of press for that. And people, I think, were actually kind of seeing themselves in the birds. And so in some ways, it can also be a means of transporting biological questions to people and making them watch out first for, of course, for nature around them, but also about like wonder about their own life in the city, for example.
Nice. So that has a healthy dose of public outreach and science communication as well, which is always really nice to hear when researchers are engaging in the public that way. But that's an interesting study topic. Would you call that humans messing around with their natural habitat, or would you call it, say, anthropogenic adaptation or something to give it a buzzword?
It's a matter of perspective, because we often think that we're improving the environment for our own sake, for example, making it more secure by having light at night. But at the same time, we're often learning too late about like the backsides of ourselves. And sometimes animals or organisms out there can be sort of a little bit of a mirror. And sometimes I think we tend to forget that we also physiologically function very much like these animals.
Very much so. So that might be what your most important thing you think of so far. But what may be more interesting to you personally as a researcher is what's the biggest questions that you're still working on? What's your biggest puzzle that you're trying to figure out and get all the answers to?
Maybe the most important question to me, or the most intriguing question, is just how evolution can have constructed a biological clock that tells, for example, birds or other organisms time over the duration of an entire year. That's just amazing. We've learned about humans that we have these very strong internal clocks. So if you go, for example, into a cave or so, you will still wake up and, you know, feed at regular intervals. But that's just a day's time. That's relatively easy to imagine how that works in the body. But now we know that organisms can do the same thing, even on an entirely uninformative conditions over the duration of an entire year. And so with a bunch of people who are very, very interested in even sort of first imagining mechanisms that would allow that.
Okay, that sounds really cool. Okay, so I know you're very, very busy, so we will try bringing the interview to a bit of a close. And to finish off, I like doing a couple of rapid-fire questions. So this is, you've had lots of time to answer the previous questions. Here I would like you to try and summarize things as quickly as you can for some kind of key take-home messages. Okay, so first of all, if there's one thing that you could have everyone out there know about your field, really appreciate and understand about it, what would it be?
Oh, we have clocks inside ourselves.
Ooh, very rapid. If you had any advice for young scientists out there who are maybe thinking about getting involved in your field or science in general, what advice would you give them?
Don't ever forget about your passion. And as long as you have it, I think you would probably find your way.
Excellent. And just the last one, you are obviously a very successful professional researcher now. You're running a lab group. What's one thing you wish people had told you about the life of a PI that you didn't know, say, earlier on in your career and you wish you did?
I don't think there's anything that I'm surprised about at this point.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Barbara. Hopefully you'll remember about us here if you have any particularly big developments or big papers, and you can come back and give us an update. I'm James Bergen, and this has been Naturally Speaking Shorts. Tune in next time. Stop. Okay, don't leave yet. Ordinarily at this point, we'd be completely done with the podcast. But after we'd finished recording, Barbara and I got chatting, and she came up with an incredibly important and viable piece of advice for early career researchers. So, we thought we'd take a double take at one of the questions I asked her earlier. What advice would you give to early career researchers who are looking at your field, wanting to get into it, are excited about science, and might want to follow a kind of career path that you've taken?
So there are the two bits of advice to this question that I have. The first is, actually, it's really worth being socially active and going to meetings. For example, if seminar speakers come around, do talk to them. They really usually are so happy to talk to young researchers. So if there's a conference or a meeting, do go talk to these people. It really is worth it, and you will later have major benefits from that. And the second bit of advice is a bit more personal, perhaps. But next to the research career, I also have three children. And sometimes people had sort of like been quite negative about that. I said, like, well, you have to make a decision, you know. A scientific career doesn't work with children. And I find this extremely unfortunate. And I don't want to sort of like belittle that it's a bit of extra effort at some points. But I was very surprised one time when I read the results from a major questionnaire of researchers, and they were asked about the perceived stress levels in life. And actually the outcome was that people who had a family actually had lower perceived stress levels than people without a family. And as I said, I was initially rather surprised by it, but I think it makes sense, because even though it's more work and more responsibility, it also helps you to balance the different things in your life in a better way. And so the overall advice would be, don't be afraid. Think about what you want in life. And, you know, there are some parts and moments when you may pay a price for it, but just don't be deterred.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter @TheNSPodcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.